For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says he plans to stay in his role as the head of the U.S. Justice Department as long as it is appropriate. His comments came after President Donald Trump told the New York Times he never would have nominated Jeff Sessions if Trump had known he'd recuse himself from leading the Russia investigation. Though the comment was a highly unusual public critique of Mr. Sessions, he says he will keep serving as U.S. Attorney General.
I have the honor of serving as Attorney General. It's something that goes beyond any thought I would have ever had for myself. We love this job, we love this department, and I plan to continue to do so as long as that is appropriate.
The EU and the UK have wrapped up the first full round of Brexit talks in Brussels, at odds on a number of key issues. Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator, says fundamental divergences remain, while his British counterpart says both sides need to show flexibility. Jack Perrock has more from Brussels.
The 4 days of the first full session of Brexit talks here in Brussels ended with the EU telling UK Brexit Minister David Davis that his team needs to provide clarifications of the UK's position on a number of issues. One of the main sticking points which has arisen is over the UK's desire to have British courts preside over cases of citizens' rights issues regarding EU nationals who currently live in the UK. The EU says they should be done at the European Court of Justice. Other issues discussed were the amount the UK will be expected to pay the EU in outstanding financial commitments and the border in Ireland. Negotiators will return to the talks in Brussels for another 4 days during the last week of August. Jack Parrock, Brussels.
Six teenagers from Burundi taking part in a robotics competition in Washington have been reported missing. Two of them are reported to have been spotted trying to cross the border into Canada. Their images have been released by police in the U.S. Capitol, from where our correspondent Daniel Wrenches reports.
The missing team members include two 17-year-old girls and four boys aged between 16 and 18 hailing from the Burundian capital Bujumbura. The adult mentor reported that they were missing as the competition was drawing to a close. Now Washington, D.C. police have posted up images of the six. The first global challenge had been a roaring success up until now, attracting 163 national and regional teams of teenagers, including much media attention on the all-Afghan women's team, initially denied visas. Daniel Wrenches, Washington.
For more on the day's top stories, you can follow us on Twitter at Feature Story. From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN.
Thanks very much, Rebecca Foster. Welcome to Thursday's Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. July 20th, 2017. It is me, Richie Allen. Tweet at Richie Allen Show right now. Tell me what you're thinking. Got a good old show lined up for you this particular Thursday. Lovely sunny evening it is here in the great, great city of Manchester.
Broadcasting live from the great city of Manchester, England. This is the Richie Allen Show on davidicke.com. It's the Richie Allen Show, brought to you in association with davidicke.com. And now, live from Manchester, England, here is Richie Allen.
It has been over 2 years since Ian Puddick was on this program. Ian is a police accountability campaigner. His own story is extraordinary. We got into this on the program over 2 years ago. Ian had an extraordinary conversation over dinner last night with a retired Scotland Yard detective who told him that he was prevented from investigating VIPs suspected of crimes against children, sexual crimes. Ian Puddick joins me. And in the second hour, I'm thrilled that legendary homeless rights activist and civil liberties activist Ted Hayes joins us live from Los Angeles. Los Angeles, homelessness in that county soared by 23% in 1 year. There are now 58,000 people homeless in Los Angeles. Ted Hayes will tell you why in the second hour. You don't want to miss that on Thursday's programme. We're going out live on davidicke.com. Do bookmark davidicke.com/headlines. We are, of course, on Fab Radio 2 in this city of Manchester and TuneIn Radio as well. Do you know all that crazy weather we were promised? Never materialised. Somebody switched off the harp. You never know. You never know. But all the thunder we were promised, we didn't get. It's quite a lovely evening now, although rain is forecast for this coming weekend. Anyway, I'm getting into the habit now of giving you the weather outlook. Maybe I shouldn't do that. Let's crack on with this programme. Radiohead. Now, they're all over the news today. Well, at least the entertainment news. Radiohead. They played a gig in Israel yesterday. And you might have been following this. People like Ken Loach, the filmmaker, among many others, were urging Radiohead not to play in Israel at Yarkon Park in Tel Aviv. Radiohead did. They went ahead. They didn't boycott Israel. And there's been a lot made of this in the press today. Thom Yorke, the singer, the lead singer of Radiohead, he said, a lot was said about this, but in the end, we played some music. Couple of comments, couple of quotes. Sarai Givati is a 35-year-old musician and no fan of Bibi Netanyahu. Sarai is an Israeli. Went to the concert and said, everyone here in this crowd didn't vote for Benjamin Netanyahu. Radiohead are playing for the people, not for the government. Sarai Givati is a musician herself. So a lot of talk about this today. I don't know how to feel about it. It's a hard one. Like I said, filmmaker Ken Loach said, don't do it on behalf of the boycott, divestment and sanctions movement. Don't play there. But the argument can be made, and we like to try and, I don't know, see every side of the argument on this particular programme. The argument can be made, they weren't playing for Zionists only, were they? And not all Israelis are supporters of the government, as we well know. I remember many years ago, I'm old enough to remember, when the great Queen went to South Africa to play a gig, and there was murders, there was blue murder afterwards, and I know that Queen, as a band and as a group and their management team, regretted it long after they did. What do you think about it? Let me know. Tweet at Richie Allen Show. If you're asking me, and I couldn't sing to save my life. I can't play an instrument either. But if you're asking me, if I was in the position of, you know, a massive group like Radiohead, would I go and do the gig? I probably wouldn't. I probably would not do the gig. My management company were booking a world tour, I would probably say, let's leave Israel out of it. But that's just me. But I would be torn knowing that there were people there who do speak up for Palestinians. There are people there who do want a solution with restoration of rights and land. What do you say about those people? What do you think? Let me know at Richie Allen Show, richie@richieallen.co.uk. The UK and the European Union, says the BBC, are still at odds over citizens' rights and the amount the UK will pay to leave. And this comes at the end of the second week of Brexit talks. The EU's negotiator, Michel Barnier, said the UK hadn't been clear enough about where it stands on these issues and this was hampering progress. David Davis, the Brexit secretary, said the negotiations on the so-called divorce bill had been robust. This is the idea of the divorce bill, the idea that several billion pounds would have to be paid by the UK for leaving the club. Davis said progress had been made, but even both sides needed to show flexibility. Barnier said, we want clarification on financial settlements, on citizens' rights, on Ireland, with the two key points of the common travel area and the Good Friday Agreement and the other separation issues, where this week's experience has quite simply shown we make better progress where our respective positions are clear. Now, German MEP Hans-Olaf Henkel, meantime, Hans has said that the EU negotiators are trying to punish the UK, making the Brexit talks as difficult as possible. Okay? Hans Olaf Henkel. Here's RT News with the story. This is interesting.
Punishing the UK, that's what the EU is doing, according to a senior German MEP who says the bloc is deliberately trying to make Britain's exit as difficult as possible. Hans-Olaf Henkel says the chief Brexit negotiator is trying to impose a bad agreement as a warning to other countries considering leaving. Theresa May has also said that EU negotiators are plotting to stop Brexit. Henkel claims that the bloc will try to make an example of Britain and make sure it is not better off outside the EU. It comes as the sides move into a second round of talks on core issues such as the rights of European citizens in the UK.
Right. Hans-Olaf Henkel. Even the Germans are admitting it. They want to punish the UK to warn off any other potential deserters. And when you're listening to that sort of rhetoric and all that sort of nonsense from Michel Barnier, leave now. No talks. It's bollocks. It's monumental bollocks. Negotiate what? You leave your tennis club, your basketball club, your drama society, your gym, your book club, your wine club, your bridge club, your mountaineering club, your walking club. Do you negotiate? No, you don't. You leave. And if you leave on good terms, you say, I've enjoyed my time at the bridge club, the gym, the book club, the wine club. Thank you. If you don't leave on terms, you say, piss off, you can stick your club up your arse. If you're a big petulant child like me, that's what you would do. And that's what we should do. Leave. It's over. There's no money. We're done. Sever every agreement we made, ever. We'll go and do our own thing now. Thank you. Good luck. We wish you well. Because when you do well, we do well. The EU. The BBC is a proper disgrace. It really is. The BBC Proms is on at the moment. What's the Proms? Well, it's an 8-week musical marathon festival on the BBC. It's not my cup of tea. I have as much culture. Not going to finish that sentence. I'm not the most cultured. Well, I am. I love plays. I'm a big theatre fan. Music and classical music, even though I live with a very, very gifted musician. Not my cup of tea. The BBC are shameless. They aired this when they could have edited it out. They aired a rant against Brexit from a conductor called Daniel Barenboim or Barenboim or Barenboim. No idea how to pronounce his name. But Daniel Barenboim is a BBC conductor. He had a good old rant against Brexit and the BBC left it in. This is what he said.
These isolationist tendencies and nationalism in its very narrow sense is something that is very dangerous and can only be fought with a real great accent on the education of the new generation. The new generations, they have to understand that Greece and Germany and France and Denmark have all something in common called European culture.
They have nothing in common. Greece has nothing in common with Germany. I reckon Daniel Barenboim should sod off to one of the countries that he mentioned. Take his baton and his poncy white gloves with him. Right. How xenophobic of me. What a muppet. I don't blame him. I blame the BBC for leaving it in. But the BBC, of course, are completely pro-European Union. I'm being told by my learned friend in Connemara that Barenboim, it must be pronounced Barenboim, but it's spelled Baron, B-O-I-M. Used to be married to Jacqueline Dupré. Remember her? I do indeed. I do indeed. Now, UKIP are not impressed with the BBC airing this rant by this conductor. I tell you, if I'd been in the gallery, not in the gallery, in the stalls, I'd have been shouting back at him. Ray Finch is a UKIP MEP. He's not impressed. Here's Ray.
It's well known that the BBC is fundamentally against Brexit. Always has been, always will be. We need to check. We need to actually evaluate whether the BBC is achieving its purpose, which is to disseminate the news and give entertainment instead of being what is now a political organisation. If it wants to be a political organisation, then that's fine, but it shouldn't expect the United Kingdom taxpayer to pay for it. It needs to raise its own revenue if it wants to do that. If it wants to be a voice of the nation, then, you know, we can do so, but not while it's a political organisation, and it is.
It's a disgrace, and he's absolutely right. There should be no public funding of the BBC. They should be made to make their own money to justify the disgraceful salaries for jug-eared Muppets like Gary Lineker. Smarmy, sneering gits like Gary Lineker getting over £2 million a year to talk about football. That's all very well and fine if the BBC generates that money commercially. It ain't fine when they're asking people to pay for it, and they're not asking. It's the law. Although I suppose most of my listeners probably don't pay it. Quarter past the hour. Listen to this. Gordon Brown, the former Prime Minister. Wait for this. The forced migration of UK children overseas was a bigger sex abuse scandal than that of Jimmy Savile. That's what Gordon Brown told the Independent Inquiry into Child Sexual Abuse today. 2,000 surviving British child migrants who suffered abuse when they were sent to Australia over decades should be compensated. He said the mass transportation of 130,000 British children was government-enforced trafficking. Yes, it was. It was disgraceful. Some of the things that happened, the depravity endured by those children sent to ex-colonies out of England from orphanages after the First World War. This continued up until the 1970s. It's disgraceful. It is indeed. It's wrong. It's an outrage. But for Brown to say that this was a national sex abuse scandal, and he says, and I quote, bigger than what people have alleged about Savile, bigger than what people have alleged about individual children's homes, said Gordon Brown. What a muppet. What a sickening bastard Brown is. What happened to those children is depraved, is horrific, must be known. But MPs were abusing children like it was an Olympic sport in this country, with the protection of the party whips and the police. Children were being murdered to protect prime ministers who had abused them. And of course, Gordon Brown will know all about that. When you share vital information on Facebook to protect people from frauds like Ken O'Keefe, as many people have done, you get banned. You make no personal comments about these people, their family or their spouse. You just provide material proof of their crimes, you get banned. But Sky News has found that Facebook, while quick to ban people from doing a public service, like saying, don't give this idiot any of your money, while they're quick to ban people like that, they're very, very slow to take down the accounts of people who sell prescription drugs online. This is true. Sky News have unearthed this. Now, David Leavesley used to work for Facebook. He's now the social media editor for the iPaper. Here is David Leavesley, former Facebook employee, as I just said, speaking with Sky News earlier today.
It's worrying, but also I think Facebook is in a very difficult situation. The internet as a whole just hasn't been given the level of control or legislation that it should have had by the time it was created. I mean, it's like the oceans in the 16th and 17th century. You'd have seas for years and years and years, and only then did they start actually trying to figure out what people could do on them. You know, Facebook is a huge company. It employs as many people as it can. But when you only have small teams of people who have to look at thousands of violations, whether they be video or photo or narcotic, they're going to end up skipping a couple of things if they don't look particularly brazen. And it's amazing that places like Sky News can flag those up when they might slip through. But when you're relying on a small team of people to do these things, there need to be larger conversations with governments and people to make sure that there is vigilance in situations like this cropping up.
There is a number of things going on here. I wasn't born yesterday. Government control of the internet is one of them. They will use an example like this to tighten controls and to give more and more and more powers to the so-called authorities to watch what you are doing online. This is a bad thing, obviously. But at the same time, Facebook is promoting the ridiculous element of the independent media, of which InfoWars, Ken O'Thief, Con O'Thief and others are prevalent. The ludicrous, racist, sensational clickbait garbage is being promoted by Facebook. And those, I'm not talking about me now, when I talk about those who go after them, because I don't make a habit of going after anybody. When I get information that's, you know, in the public interest, I'll publish it. And when somebody is defrauding people out of money, it is in the public interest and it should be published. Those people are shut down. You see what's going on. So this is multifaceted. And of course, as my great friend and colleague Hayden Hewitt has said many, 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 many times, how did we allow it become so that we have been corralled, 2 billion people now corralled on Facebook 24/7, giving up our own individual websites, which we used to have. We used to have lovely websites where we were in total control of what went on those websites and what didn't. Now we're at the mercy of Facebook and very soon government censors. Extraordinary. 20 minutes past the hour. The Richie Allen Show live on davidicke.com. Ted Hayes live from Los Angeles in the second hour. Before that, can't wait to speak with Ian Puddick. Not on this programme for over 2 years. Ian Puddick in a minute.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete. The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imagings may be the long-awaited answer, designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Sign up today. Email Sue on nassusproductions@gmail.com.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with davidicke.com.
22 minutes past the hour. We've got our first guest right up to the top of the hour. Let me introduce him for those of you who maybe haven't heard of him and his extraordinary story. He was on this program just over 2 years ago. Can't believe it's as long as that. He's a plumber by trade, but these days also, importantly, a well-known campaigner for police accountability. Several years ago, Ian Puddick confronted the man with whom his wife was having an affair. The man was Tim Haynes, a former director of multinational city insurance company Guy Carpenter. Now, Ian suffered extraordinary levels of victimisation when counter-terrorism detectives from the City of London Police conducted an inquiry into his activities after Tim Haynes hired private detective agency Kroll to go after Ian. This is extraordinary, but it all happened. Ian had contacted some of Tim Haynes' clients and Tim Haynes' wife to inform them of the sort of man Haynes was. Fair enough. Now, this was sensational at the time, and it was true. Kroll had close ties to the police, who began to harass Ian, spending over £1 million of taxpayers' money. There's too much detail for me to get into. Threatening phone calls, following Ian, arresting him, asking him to confess to having cocaine. This was unbelievable. It would have driven lesser men, I think, to suicide. But Ian, this all went to court back in 2011, and Ian won. He'd been putting this story online, and of course the people he was talking about didn't like that. It's a much bigger story, and I can link you to it because there are many, many YouTube videos. And I'll link you, of course, to Ian's website as well, and I'll do that on Twitter now and on Facebook. Delighted to welcome back to this programme Ian Puddick. Ian, welcome.
Yeah, good evening, Richie. Thanks for having me on the show again.
It's great to have you on. I can't believe it's been 2 years, and I mean that sincerely.
Despite being censored after our last one.
I must point out, because I haven't said this to our listeners, every interview we ever did went on YouTube. The only one ever taken down by YouTube was the one I did with Ian for a community standards violation, and they wouldn't give us any explanation. There was no profanity in it. Everything Ian said was true. It was all public record. Out of the 1,200 or so videos we've put up, the only one they ever took down was yours. That's a true story. Welcome back, mate, and congratulations on the work you continue to do. You had an interesting dinner last night with a former Scotland Yard detective. Tell us about it.
I did, yeah. Obviously, I won't name names. Had dinner with a former Scotland Yard detective that worked specifically in the paedophile unit. Now, as a general rule, officers only spend 2 years in that department for obvious reasons. But this particular specific officer is now retired, by the way. We met up to talk about, you know, police accountability and all of the rest of it. And I actually didn't know that he'd actually worked in the actual paedophile unit. I knew he'd worked at Scotland Yard and he was a senior officer, but didn't actually know that he'd worked in that office until last night. So I was gobsmacked. So I was asking all the right questions, well, hopefully asking all the right questions. We talked about police accountability in terms of Operation Countryman, and he knew some of the very senior officers that were taking cash bungs, but, you know, were all able to retire on ill health. I can come to that and go into some detail if you wanted me to, which is quite interesting. But the big thing, and the reason I sent a tweet out this afternoon saying, look, you know, just had dinner last night with a Scotland Yard officer that was in the paedophile unit. And he told me, so this isn't coded message or some insinuation or me trying to read something into what he may have said. He made it very, very clear that in the mid-80s that he and his department were investigating Leon Britton, and they were specifically told to stop. Now, you know, we know the CSA inquiry sort of ruled him out. But, you know, this was said to me directly, you know, man to man, while talking.
How did he feel about that, Ian? I mean, you know,
He was appalled. I'm not going to mention names, but, you know, I spoke to you off air and there were some other names that also came up. And I didn't tweet those. But Leon Britton being a high profile, well, he was the former Home Secretary, So, yeah, it just shows that all animals are equal, but some are more equal than others.
You mentioned to me today that you knew the people behind Exaro News, which, sadly, it must be said, isn't around anymore. And they were doing a lot of work on this and on Britain, and the and of course the Dickens dossier, which was handed to Leon Britton, was the dossier with a number of names of presumably very important members of the establishment whom were believed to be abusing children. And Britton inexplicably lost the dossier, didn't he?
He did, yeah. And then when the Home Office, during the early stages of the CSA inquiry, when they were looking for the dossier and all of the associated paperwork regarding the various meetings and everything surrounding that, absolutely everything had been lost or went missing.
Did your contact, Ian, did he give you an idea? Again, obviously, without mentioning names, but who would have said, listen, lads, we're going to stop this particular investigation?
Absolutely. I mean, that was
Chief Superintendent, would it?
That was one of my questions. He explained to me, I mean, I'm not going to give away his name and I'm not going to give away his rank, but it was reasonably senior. He obviously had a commanding officer who he said was absolutely fantastic. And the person above him and his boss told them that they had to stop. And there were actually four people at that time involved in the actual investigation of Leon Britton, and they were all asked to stop.
And the reason one of the reasons I brought up Exaro News is because they ran stories saying that this was pretty common, that in other parts of the country, when detectives were getting to, you know, when they were getting somewhere with these investigations, they were stonewalled and they were moved on to other investigations and told, lads, we're shutting this one down. This was common.
Yeah. Well, the reason for my interest in this is, you know, child abuse is certainly not my subject. My issues are about, I say, police corruption, but the causes of police corruption, which is obviously the culture within the police, that allows these behaviours to pervade. And the real issue is lack of any real accountability. So, you know, I'm looking at it from the perspective saying, hang on, these are officers, they're investigating a crime or an allegation of a very, very serious crime. They've sworn an oath to uphold the truth, to uphold the law. They are impartial, or they're perceived to be impartial. I mean, actually, obviously, I know that's complete nonsense. But that's my interest. You know, how can these law-abiding officers that have made this sworn this oath of office to do the right thing, how can they have pressure put on them to stop? I can see the practical side of it. You know, you're working in a small department, you're working with colleagues, you've got your pension, you've got your career to think of, you've been an officer for X amount of years, what are you going to go and do? Going to go and be a milkman? Probably not. So, you know, I can see the human pressure on these people, but it's the lack of integrity. And it's generally the people at the top that are making these decisions.
It's generally people at the top. The thing about these guys as well is, and again, I'm not trying to be dramatic or sensational, but some of these guys would have been aware of how serious this is. And they would have been aware that, you know, people get killed, you know, when you go after the establishment, when you start to pull away, you know, at the fabric of what holds the establishment together. I want to just mention one thing. You know, we do talk about conspiracy theories on this program, but I generally tend to keep my powder dry. I've never been satisfied with the explanation around the death of Britain. We were told Britain died of cancer back in January 2 years ago. Now, Britain was a very, very, very high profile guy, and nobody had any clue, including some very close friends of Britain, who actually, in the day or two after Britain died, were doing these interviews on Sky and the BBC, talking about his career, these obituaries they were doing. And a lot of these people expressed complete surprise. They had no idea this guy was ill. I always wonder about Britain, not only him, but that other guy whose name escapes me now, who was abusing children in Leicester, Greville Janner, who died suddenly as well. You've got to ask these questions, Ian, you know. I know that a lot of people don't like asking them because it puts people off, and people say, oh, these crazy conspiracy theorists. But Britain was key to this inquiry that's going on at the moment, because he had the dossier, and he was suspected of abusing children himself. I mean, I believe Leon Britton was an abuser of children. I've seen enough evidence to support that.
I do, and that's not because I had dinner with a senior police officer who just happened to tell me that, so I'm just repeating it. You know, throughout all my trials and tribulations with the Counterterrorism Directorate, City of London Police. You know, I often tweet this, because people, I'm always labelled as a police hater, and I get abusive messages from police officers saying, I hope when you get burgled, you don't call us, mate, and all this kind of stuff. And, you know, they just don't, you know, I'm not against the police. You know, I'm with the police. You know, I think the police should get more money. You know, I really do. I really do. You know, I watch some of the documentaries on the TV and I think, oh my God, you know, how do they do that work? But the point is, they're public servants. And they should be held to account just like anybody else. And I would say that about anybody in the public eye that's paid public money, you know, they should be accountable. And it's not an unreasonable thing to say. It's just that there's this culture where if you criticise them, you're seen as a police hater. And that's not just me. You know, that's other people like myself that you know, stand up against the police for all the issues and all the things that go wrong.
Well said. And I want to talk. I want to talk in general about corruption in a minute. I just want to mention, Ian's website is cityoflondonpolicecorruption.co.uk. That's cityoflondonpolicecorruption.co.uk. Bookmark that. We'll talk about it in a minute. I mean, we know that the whips, you know, were talking on the record in the late 1990s, saying that MPs buggering young boys was a regular thing. They would go to the whips in order to be absolved, and the whips would use, you know, a sort of a currency. They would use that over their heads and stuff like that. I suppose because of the endemic corruption, we have to think that most people can't imagine the sort of scale that child abuse has been, maybe still is, but has been historically operating at in this country. I mean, we're talking absolute epidemic levels, all levels of the establishment, massive cover-ups. I mean, you'll know all about Edward Heath, Ian, and I mean, there's just an abundance of evidence that Heath was abusing children. Not only that, but that some of those children never saw the light of day, lest they speak about it. Do you think, do you hold out any hope before we move away from child abuse? Because as you said, to be fair to you, it's not an area you specialise in. Do you hold out any real hope that this particular child abuse inquiry is really going to get to the bottom of what happened or is happening.
No. Well, we already know that, you know, the Met Police have apologised to Leon Britton's wife. So in the early stages, he was immediately cleared of any wrongdoing. You know, the reason I tweeted out the thing about Leon Britton, as I said, it wasn't specifically because I'd had dinner last night, which obviously I did. But I got information from my friends. I call them friends, people, trusted friends at Exaro News. And also when I had all my trials and tribulations, I was helped by a very, very, very senior police officer who was not from City of London Police. You know, on one occasion I was actually told not to be in on a Friday because they were going to come and raid my home, which they did. And I made sure I was out. And then I got a phone call. I got a phone call from Lena at the time saying that, you know, the police are all here. I didn't say anything to anyone. And then they arrested me by appointment the next day. They said, come in at 11 o'clock and blah, blah, blah. So they didn't have to send six officers round to my house to arrest me. When a phone call would have said, could you come down at 11 o'clock tomorrow? And obviously I turned up. But the point is that senior officer that helped me gave me an instance where when he was doing what he was doing at the time, he was saying that Leon Britton had been, and because obviously because of who he was when he was the Home Secretary, he was asked at Victoria Station for looking for rent boys. And he was, you know, just not cautioned, but just, you know, you don't want to be here, sir, type thing, and was asked to sort of make a hasty retreat. Whereas, you know, anybody else doing that behaviour would have been, you know, handcuffed on and back of the van and straight down to the nick. And again, it's the lack of accountability that, you know, they're not upholding the law for everybody. Some animals, it's fairer for some animals, as George Orwell would say.
My friend and colleague Jean-Anne Crowley has made two interesting points to me. She's my honorary producer these days, helps me out with content from time to time. Jersey detectives have come forward and said that they were told to drop it. That's absolutely right. And Jean-Anne is pointing out that the City of London, most people don't know what it is and what it represents. It's like the Vatican and Washington, D.C. And again, we could spend all night talking about that. Let me just do a quick recap. Ian Puddick, police accountability campaigner, is on the line. And by the way, folks, you know, if you want to hear about corruption, what happened to Ian Puddick, who, you know, named, went and said, look, this very powerful director of a very powerful company has had an affair with my wife. And what this guy did through a detective agency which had close ties with the police was set out to destroy Ian and make his life an absolute misery. But the police were all too willing to help. And you have to think about that, how that can happen in a so-called free, open society democracy where the police can do that on behalf of a powerful corporation, can go after a man who did nothing wrong. And I meant what I said in the introduction. A lot of lesser men would have killed themselves, Ian, what you were going through. You had a very strong mind.
Yeah, I mean, you're very kind. I mean, I don't know if I should say this or not. I was brought up as a Jehovah's Witness. I've come from a very orthodox, a very black and white background. I was a minister in the Jehovah's Witness religion. So you had a really clear world view. You know, the Jehovah's Witnesses are the true religion. Everybody else outside, a part of Satan's system. However, you know, you respect law and authority. And if a policeman says stand over there, you don't ask why, you just do it. So I just was absolutely appalled when they were raiding my house. They raided my company. They raided the major economic crimes director, raided my company accountants, who had nothing to do with this. And this is not about an affair for me. I always say that, you know, if I'd gone plastering this chap's name all over the internet and going, oh, my wife had an affair with Joe Bloggs, then it becomes about Joe Bloggs. So I was very, very careful that in everything that I did, I never named the guy. Not because there's any restrictions. I can name him now. I still don't. Because the minute I start saying my wife had an affair with Joe Bloggs, it becomes about Joe Bloggs. The point is, if my wife had had an affair with, and let's be frank, it's no more Joe Bloggs' fault than it would have been my wife.
The
issue is, if my wife had had an affair with the postman, I wouldn't have been raided by the counter-terrorist police. They wouldn't have spent £1.5 million investigating me, and you and I wouldn't probably be talking. That's the point. That's the real issue, if that makes sense.
Staggering stuff. 20 minutes to the top of the hour. We've got Ian till the top of the hour. So let's make use of it. City of London, policecorruption.co.uk. Is corruption amongst police forces around the country, is it endemic, Ian, do you think, in your experience now, knowing what you know because of your investigations since what happened to you, is it epidemic?
Absolutely. But it depends what you call corruption. So, you know, there's different levels of corruption, but, you know, corruption is corruption. So, you know, you and I went to school together. I'm a police officer. I catch you speeding. You know, you pull the window down. I say, oh, Richard, I haven't seen you for 25 years, and I give you a clip round the ear. Metaphorically speaking, and say, look, don't do it again. And you go, you know, I haven't upheld the law. You know, does that happen? I'm sure it does all day long. Because we're human. We're human. We are human. I'm not suggesting it's right, but I'm saying we're human. However, when you get to the standards of, say, for example, we'll talk about Geoffrey Dickens and his dossier. Well, Geoffrey Dickens, named in Parliament, so this is a conspiracy, you know, he named it in Parliament, there's a public record of it. He named Sir Peter Hayman, a British diplomat and a deputy director of MI6, who was a paedophile. And he was also, Sir Peter Hayman was on the PI, the Paedophile Information Exchange. He was a member of that under a pseudonym called Peter Henderson. And when the police raided Sir Peter Hayman's flat, in Notting Hill, they found all child abuse material and some really, really sick stuff, which I'm not going to talk about. And he was cautioned. Now, to anybody else, you know, the cuffs would be on the back of the van. There's the murder of Daniel Morgan. There's Hillsborough. There's one for me, probably one of the worst ones for me personally, only because I'm just a complete wimp. There was a chap up in the East Midlands called Stephen Kiskow. He had learning difficulties. He lived with his mum. And the police framed him for the murder and rape of a young girl. And they knew he was innocent. And it was only a TV programme in the 80s, a BBC, I can't remember the name of the documentary, that got him released. And he was beaten up. He was brutalised. I dread to think what kind of life that poor man led in, and he came out of prison. He died very, very shortly after.
Ian, was he framed to protect somebody else? Do you think? The
police knew who he was. They'd made a mistake. They went with an easy option, and then they realised during the investigation that it wasn't him. But they continued with it, got him banged up. The real child murderer and child rapist is walking free. And do you know what happened to those guys? They retired early on ill health.
On a pension.
Operation Countryman. I don't know if you saw the documentary that I sent you this afternoon, World in Action.
No, I didn't get a chance to watch it, but I'm going to watch it when I finish the programme. Tell us about that. Yeah.
And the Home Office tried to ban that documentary. I went to ITN and paid to get a licence to put it on my website for the simple reason that, well, they said it's banned. And I said, well, hang on, when that came out, there wasn't any internet. The terms of the reference on the ban, I run a plumbing company, I'm not a lawyer, but they can't have included the internet because there wasn't an internet to ban it from. And they checked it out and said, yeah, can we have, you know, X amount of money, please, and you can have it. So I got the licence to broadcast that. I put that on, tweeted about it. It got over 100,000 views in 3 months.
Fantastic.
And then it was removed from YouTube by the police, who complained. And obviously I was able to produce the license, and then they put it back up, and it went up and down about 3 times, and now I think it's got about 16,000 views or something.
Ian, remind our listeners, as far as I can gather, Operation Countryman, senior police officers, the flying squad, were taking bribes from gangsters who were doing massive armed robberies, basically.
There was spin-offs from it as well. So there was Detective Chief Superintendent Tony Lundy, there's another World in Action on that. Who back in the early 90s, 92, was taking 100k bribes.
100k at that time.
A nice chunk of money. You imagine that in 1992,
yeah,
back in the late 80s. And what came out in the documentary is the senior police officers knew about it and turned a blind eye. And when it all was exposed on World in Action, he retired on ill health, and they not only pensioned him off, he got an enhanced police pension for ill health. And the irony was, World in Action caught up with him just after that, when he just completed the London Marathon. And that was the irony, that he was on ill health and he completed the London. I mean, it just made a mockery of the whole thing. So the point you asked me about, you know, is corruption endemic? You know, are all police officers corrupt? The answer has got to be no. They're not all corrupt. But I was invited to Parliament to a debate on police accountability, and the previous commissioner, Hogan Howe, got up, gave this great speech and said that the police have never, ever been so accountable. They're held to account by the IPCC, they're held to account by the public, they're held to account by the press and the media, and in public, you know, social media. The police have never had so much scrutiny, which is probably true to an extent. However, he went on to give this wonderful speech about how, you know, it's never been so clean. And then after that was Professor Louise Marland, who'd been commissioned by the Home Office to look at police corruption. And she gave a completely different account. And this is only 3 years ago, so it's not like 20 years ago. It's only 3 years ago. And she said that police corruption was endemic. And she said the problem with police corruption is that they have this blue code where they don't rat on each other.
Now, right.
And that's the problem. So a perfect example is my case. After the judge had cleared me for creating a threatening, harassing website, the judge said to me, "You know what caused you to create the actual website?" You know, she understood the case, but why did you create a website? So I said, because I wanted to get the message out there. None of the press were particularly interested. All they were interested in was the salacious aspects. You know, there was an affair and they wanted to know the details of the affair. Well, I've never really talked about that. All I've said is it started with an affair. You know, if I could start the story by saying one day I was raided by the terrorist police,
yeah,
my company
yeah.
was raided, and that was it. That would be a great start. But everyone wants to know why. And, you know, unfortunately, the reason why is you know, it's a nonsense reason, but it's a genuine reason. So she talked about this blue code that they all hold up. So in my case, I said to the judge, the police brutalized me in custody. I'm a big guy, but I'm not a tough guy. I'm a complete wimp. And I came out of the police station as an adult, as a big guy, crying. And I was crying because I was scared, not crying because I'd felt intimidated. I was scared. And I always say to people, as adults, when was the last time you were afraid? When were you scared? You know, I don't mean nervous or a bit anxious or a bit unsure, but when were you frightened? And normally it's an emotion you experience as a child. You might feel nervous or anxious, but you don't feel frightened. And I said, I came out of the police station because I was frightened. And they'd brutalized me, and I was in tears. And I just came out, and I vowed I'm not going to let them get away with it. And I said, if they did that to a 14-year-old black kid on some dodgy estate in southeast London, we'd all be saying, oh, he's clearly a criminal, he's a troublemaker, he's a gang member, he was a drug dealer, he was this. Not that that justifies their behaviour in any shape or form.
It doesn't, no,
but if they can do that to a white middle-class man that has a business that employs people, they can do that to anyone. And she said, I agree. So she said, I want those two officers here in an hour. So the first officer, they both called. Whatever they were doing that day, they got a phone call saying, "Get down to Westminster Magistrates Court within the hour." So the first officer comes in, Colin Dawson. He had complete amnesia. My barrister is firing questions in. He had complete amnesia about what happened in that room. The second officer, Sergeant Ellis, John Ellis, who brutalised me. He faltered. First of all, he tried to say during the passing of time, I cannot recall, and all this kind of stuff. My barrister just got him, absolutely got him. And then he turned around and said, I remembered why I had to interview Mr. Puddick. I took him through to the interview room. It wasn't an interview room. There was no tape record. I wasn't read my rights. There was no interview. And he just said, because what I had to do, I was searching Mr. Puddick's property, and I just remembered I found large quantities of crack cocaine throughout his property. At this point, I'm in the dock for my website, which I very proudly created, and I shouted out, you lie, and the judge told me off. And he came out with all this nonsense and said that he found crack cocaine in my kitchen, my bedroom, my loft room, and then under cross-examination, he was forced to admit that he forgot to confiscate it, he forgot to discuss it with any of the other officers that
left
are on
it all
there.
Behind, didn't speak to anybody about it.
It's still in my house now because I've not taken
Genius.
It, given it away or sold it.
Genius,
it has
yeah.
to still be there. And I still write to City of London Police and invite them to come and do a search of my property to recover the drugs that Sergeant Ellis found everywhere but forgot to take. They just ignore me. But it just shows how farcical it is. Forgot to make notes in his notepad. My barrister's going, well, this urgent interview, obviously that's recorded. You made notes from the interview. Oh, no, I didn't record the interview. You must have made notes from it. No, I forgot to. Just lied and lied and lied and walked out of court. So after my trial, I then complained to the IPCC, because you have to, because there's nowhere else to go to, and said, you know, I'm not a lawyer. Was it conspiracy to pervert the course of justice? Was it malfeasance in public office? Was it perjury? Well, in my mind, it was all of those things, obviously.
Of course it was.
So then after that, other police officers came through and said, do you know what? We were searching Mr. Shoo! I found that and I saw that as well. And they all forgot to remove it. So they all left it there. So that's the point of corruption. The good officers that generally probably wouldn't go and lie under oath and stand there and look at you in the eye and tell a point blank lie, those same officers, when forced, pull together, close ranks and protect one another.
And we'll do it. Do you know what
that's
I was
the blue code.
Listening to you, of course, two things are apparent. You know, you're a nice guy, you've got your business. When something like that happens to you, it pulls the walls down of the world that you imagine you live in. I live in a world where there's fairness and justice and decency, and then you're getting a pasting off a couple of bent coppers, and you know, it would have done the same thing to me as it did to you. I'd have been absolutely devastated. And I'm sure I'd have been crying about it and thinking, how can this happen?
I didn't have to get mine back. How do you get your own
you
back
can't. Yeah, you can't.
Justice on the school bully when the school bully's dad is the headmaster, the deputy headmaster is the school bully's, how do you do that? So what I did was I created my website. I found out where every single police officer lived for some friendly journalists. I doorstepped every single one of them, stood there with my little video camera and said, my name's Ian Puddick, and they all knew who I was. You spent over £1 million investigating me for nothing. The public would like to know why. They would then, I put it on YouTube, they'd come around and arrest me. They would then keep me locked up for 6 hours and release me without charge. I even did that to Adrian Leppard, the commissioner, down at his house in Reigate in Surrey. I went and doorstepped him.
That's right.
I just embarrassed them.
That took enormous courage, by the way. You said you're a wimp earlier on, and I think when we spoke 2 years ago, you said you're a wimp. You're not a wimp. That takes courage. It takes balls to do that. Fair play to you. Do you know what I want to say, Ian? Because we're going to run out of time in 2 or 3 minutes. One of the things I wanted to say, you imagine now what you've taught me about Operation Countryman, the other things, you know, the other horrible things you've talked about there, poor man, Stephen Kishko, and all these things. Can you imagine what will happen when, not if, the law enforcement in this country is privatised, because it is being run into the ground by successive governments to pave the way for privatisation. At least it is, in my opinion. Imagine what sort of force you'll have then.
Of course. I know I digress very briefly, I never got a second, but I went to Andrew Mitchell's trial, the Plebgate trial, and the police lied through their teeth. And because the judge, I'm not suggesting the judge was corrupt, because the judge was a civil judge looking at civil cases and not criminal law, which is different, he just believed the police because he just didn't believe all these police officers could possibly lie, and they lied through their teeth, and some of it was it's just so ridiculous, so ridiculous.
It's absolutely ridiculous. Just going to give the website details again. It's cityoflondonpolicecorruption.co.uk. That's where you can find out everything you need to know about Ian. Ian, just for, again, not to be, you know, in any way kind of flippant or glib, how many of these guys do you think at the very top are involved in secret societies? You're probably saying to yourself in your mind, the bastard, he shouldn't be asking me stuff like that.
But no, you can ask me. No, I mean, I said to you today.
The Masons and officers. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm not a Freemason. I've never been a Freemason. I personally think that if a police officer is going to be Freemasons, then they should declare it. You know, that's all. Same with judges. I think judges should, you know. But I know, to answer your question directly, three of the very senior officers, Detective Superintendent, Jeff, his name's just gone now because his name's just gone. But three of the very senior officers were, or are.
Listen, mate, I'll be in touch with you again real soon. We certainly won't be leaving it as long as last time for you to come back on the programme. City of London Police Corruption. .co.uk. Thanks for sharing that bit of info today, and thanks so much for coming back on the programme, Ian.
My pleasure. Thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you back on. Ian Puddick on the line to us there from his home in London. Extraordinary stuff, that. His story, what happened to him, and the levels of harassment, intimidation that he had to put up with from agents of the City of London Police. It's quite staggering, really. If you put Ian Puddick online, you'll get all the newspaper articles from 2011 when you know, he had his victory in court. Amazing stuff. It's exactly 6 minutes to the top of the hour. This is your Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2 and TuneIn Radio. Aaron, my friend and webmaster, just sent me a little bit of info there. Just to remind you, Stefan Kijko was in prison for 16 years for the murder and sexual assault of a schoolgirl called Leslie Malseed, a crime he didn't commit. He was freed on appeal back in 1992. Evidence emerged that he couldn't have killed her. He died the following year from a heart attack, aged 41. And as Aaron says, nice and tidy that was. No doubt about it. We're going to take a very quick break. This is, it's time for you to tweet me. Tweet at Richie Allen Show. Email richie@richieallen.co.uk. Back in 90 seconds.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imagings may be the long-awaited answer. Designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Sign up today. Email Sue on nassusproductions@gmail.com.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
There's a place high in the mountains of Spain, a sanctuary where souls gather from all around the globe to learn about themselves and experience powerful changes in the way we see our world. They become awakened to their gifts and their power to heal others. Become part of this ever-growing worldwide family of unique, pure energy healing practitioners. Discover how amazing you truly are. Go to www.markbajerski.com. It could just change your life forever.
Broadcasting the information the mainstream media won't touch. This is the Richie Allen Show in association with davidicke.com. Richie Allen.
Welcome back, Richie Allen indeed, live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, TuneIn Radio and richieallen.co.uk. Live. Live. I'll say it again. Faisal tweets that Ben Elton's book High Society is a very good read, starkly portraying the kind of breathtaking police corruption explained by Ian Puddick there. Thanks, Faisal, for the tip on that. Rich Mortimer tweets, Ian is very brave. He could have gone missing in the night. Good on him. He is brave. He shouldn't say he's a wimp. To go around to these people, to their houses, to doorstep them, which is an old broadcasting term for not giving somebody any notice that you're going to turn up. You just turn up and doorstep them. It takes enormous courage, and I have a great admiration for him as well. Hi to Jay Ferguson, to Millie, to Mark Morrison, to Tony, to Angela. How you doing, Angela? And to everybody else who's tweeting this Thursday. Great to know you're listening to the programme. Thanks for doing that. We're fast approaching the top of the hour. It is Thursday, July 20th, 2017. We will be speaking with Ted Hayes live. Ted Hayes live from Los Angeles in a couple of minutes' time. Ted is a civil liberties activist, a legendary fighter for the rights of homeless people in Los Angeles, and a really, really great guy. I came across Ted. He gave an interview to the BBC, not a broadcast interview. It was a print interview, and Ted was talking about the fact that homelessness in Los Angeles soared by an incredible 23% last year. That's staggering, that. 58,000 people now are homeless in Los Angeles. Why is that happening? Ted talks about the gentrification of the downtown area. That should be familiar to people living in Kensington and Chelsea and Westminster and other places where they want to socially cleanse poor people. Can't wait to speak with Ted Hayes. Ted's daughter, Joanna, by the way, won the gold medal at the Olympics in Athens in 2004 in the 100 metres hurdles. So I'm looking forward to speaking with Ted. He joins the programme in a couple of minutes' time. So when he is on with me, feel free to tweet the programme as usual. It's at Richie Allen Show, or you can email richie@richieallen.co.uk. Don't get so many emails these days. Most people moving on to Twitter because it's much more instant. It's very quick to tweet a comment. So, and you can join in with everybody else and you can tweet what those people are tweeting. Chris says that his tweets and links don't show up on my feed. They do, Chris. I've just seen your link there. Thank you. So, and Jackie, who's going to be on the programme soon, by the way, to talk about very, very important subject. I'll tell you more about it maybe before the end of the programme, if I get time. Jackie says, Richie, I'm starting to believe that the police are aliens. Like, I swear to God, listening to the stories told by Ian there. Yes, indeed. We've got John Farnham lined up. This is John Farnham, and this is called You're the Voice. Now, Ted Hayes joins us live from LA. Should say Los Angeles. It's a bit pretentious, that, LA. Seeing as I've never been there. Probably never will be either. This is Europe's most listened to independent radio show, Your Richie Allen Show, broadcasting live on davidicke.com, Fab Radio 2, and TuneIn Radio. My name is Richie Allen. Ted Hayes is next. This is John Farnham.
We have the chance to turn the pages on. We can write what we want to write. We gotta make ends meet before we get much older. We're all someone's daughter. We're all someone's daughter.
exactly 5 minutes past the hour. John Farnham's You're the Voice on the Richie Allen Show, Thursday, July 20th, 2017. You're just joining the programme. You missed Ian Puddick in the first hour. Don't worry about that. The programme, as always, will be podcasted shortly after it ends, and the interviews will be on YouTube shortly thereafter. Welcome back to the programme. The BBC said yesterday that homelessness in Los Angeles County soared by 23% in the past year. And the BBC says it shows. It's become tangible and inescapable, with makeshift tent encampments cropping up across the sprawling metropolis. The BBC writes that tourists are shocked to find themselves stepping over people draped in filthy blankets and begging on Hollywood's Walk of Fame. Shop owners routinely swill the pavements to wash away urine and the accompanying stench. This is staggering. It leapt from 46,874 in 2016 to 58,000 this year. Now, our next guest is a pretty extraordinary man. He's very, very well known in his native Los Angeles for his activism on behalf of the homeless, and his long-time campaign to promote initiatives to empower the homeless population of Los Angeles. He's been involved in some very successful and very well-known projects like the Justiceville Shantytown and the very famous innovative Dome Village, which helped to build cheap and safe housing for the homeless in Los Angeles. I think this man is a bit of a national treasure. Let's welcome to the programme Ted Hayes, who's live in Los Angeles. Ted, I'm so glad you were able to connect and come on the programme. You're very welcome, sir.
Well, cheers to you, Richard Allen. I'm honoured to be sharing my views with your listeners in Manchester and around the world.
Thanks, Ted. Homelessness, of course, it's a very, very, it's a very big subject, and we'll get into it, of course, and we'll try and explain what's going on. Before we do that, how has it leaped so dramatically in just a 12-month period in Los Angeles? What's going on in your city, Ted?
The same thing that goes on in all cities, but just on a more steroid level, is politics. Partisan politics and insensitivity on the part of our government leaders and movers and shakers in society. And also, though, I think, you know, people want to accuse the rich and the wealthy and the workers of being insensitive and don't care about homeless people. But I disagree with that. I think most people, all people pretty much, care about their fellow human beings. But when you look at homelessness, for example, and see how difficult of an issue it is, and people don't know how to fix it, they'd rather turn away and look away, especially individuals who are heart sensitive and they care. There's nothing worse than caring for someone, a child, for example, and you can't do nothing about it. You just turn your feelings off, and that's the problem. People do not have a vision of hope that we can actually resolve homelessness in L.A., America, or around the world, for that matter.
I think around the world, Ted, people do make assumptions as well about people whom are homeless. I see it here in Manchester, which the homeless population in this city, which is a very big city, it's not obviously anything as big as Los Angeles, but it's a big city. We've seen an increase in the homeless population here over the last few years as well. And people, I think people do stereotype homeless people. They imagine drug abuse, they imagine prostitution. But what we're finding, and nobody knows more about homelessness in Los Angeles than you, increasingly, Ted, people who have worked sometimes two jobs, sometimes three jobs, but low income jobs, have not been able to meet the ever-increasing, you know, cost of life, the cost of living, and have very quickly found themselves in trouble. I mean, we say here, you know, a lot of us in this city are only one missed paycheck, Ted, or two missed paychecks away from being on the street. A lot of assumptions are made about homeless people, but a lot of people whom are homeless now and are finding themselves homeless are people that are not addicted, don't have mental health issues. They've just not been able to live in an ever increasingly expensive society. What do you think?
What I've learned, and I lived with homeless people 30 years ago in downtown LA on Skid Row when it's just getting started. I did it on purpose to feel it, smell it, know it, so that when I would represent the homeless issue in the future, I would speak from my heart and not from my head. And I also went to find answers, and thank God I did find some answers to it. One of the answers is this. You mentioned earlier the cost of living, the rat race, the proverbial rat race. I find that when people initially become homeless, falling out of the mainstream, as it were, and they hit the streets, at first they're angry, they're upset, they're embarrassed, and they're just beside themselves. But then they go through the various rehabilitation programs and systems to get back on their feet, job training, to get back into society. When they get back there, those who do make it, they get knocked right back in again because things are worse off now post when they were initially pushed into the streets. And so what happens is, like a slave that wanders off of a plantation and tastes freedom suddenly, that slave would rather die in the filth of a swamp than go back to slavery. And what has happened with homeless people, and I experienced this in London. I was in Manchester, London. I've been to England several times playing cricket. And while there, I had a chance to speak with certain people who are living what you would call rough down by the London train yard there. And he said that, this one guy said, you know, I went to the program, I got a place, they put me in an apartment way across town, had no friends, no money, I'm just in a room by myself. He said, you know what, I gave it up and I came back to be with my friends. Others have said here in America and England that they've gone through the program, get all the way to the top and realize the same rat race is there. And what they do now is they've acclimate to their environment and they maintain their sanity. And here in Venice Beach, for example, they're all over. They've got little skid rows in Santa Monica, Venice Beach. And these guys are kicking back. They've realized, you know what? We're free. We have no rent. We have no utilities, no alimony, no nothing. I will stay here. There's guys out here, you could pay them $20 an hour to work on a regular, consistent basis. They won't do it. They'll do it for a day or so, but not on a regular basis because they don't want to get re-entrapped into the mainstream rat race.
That's an extraordinary thing, Ted. I've never heard that said before. It kind of makes the kind of a perverse sense to me listening to that.
It does make sense. I mean, you're looking at a guy here who...
You're talking about rejecting society, Ted. You're talking about people who, because of their experience, their negative experience of an uncaring rat race, a terrible society, they just reject it completely, right?
Absolutely. You look at the millennials. Okay, so-called millennials. These kids, they've lost it. They've given up. They don't see a future in England or Germany or France or the United States. So they drug and drink and just kick back until whenever happens. People need hope. And the scripture says that without a vision, the people perish. And we have no vision around the world right now. That's why we're all dying. We're all having this experience.
We're seeing here as well as you, Ted, an increasing amount of working class, even what we call middle class or middle income people finding themselves homeless. One of the biggest charities in the country, Oxfam, has said there are more children going to bed hungry in working families than ever before.
That's absolutely true. I can see it. It's happening here as well. You know, again, it's you know, what we've been doing as people, as societies, we have been focusing on the homeless and homelessness. But it's not homeless that we should be focused on, because homeless people did not drop out of the sky. Hungry people didn't just grow up from the ground. They came from within humanity. And that's why we call our movement the New Frontier 2 Operation Humanity, because we're learning to use homelessness as the catalyst to rectify the sickness within humanity that creates homelessness. It's almost like snake venom being used as an antidote to a snake bite.
I get the picture, Ted. Both of our governments are, and I'm not just talking about the current governments, I mean the previous governments as well.
Yes, sir. Policies
are enacted which drive wealth, title, privilege, money uphill to what we call the 1% or the elite. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's happening. And it's facilitated by some of the biggest banks in the world, and the corruption levels are endemic. The problem we have is we get to choose from people. Now, I know you've stood for election before, to your credit, but generally we get to choose from people, Ted, and generally the two candidates or the four candidates or the five candidates, they are owned lock, stock and barrel by big business. How do we change it, Ted?
We change it by we have to change it. You know, here in the United States, in our Constitution, the preamble, the first statement in the Constitution says, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union. I think that's a universal statement for all countries. It is our fault as people that we allow these tycoons and these cronies to continue to rule over us. It's our fault that we do not supervise our politicians. We have now, for the first time in human history, we have devices like the one that we're using right now to communicate with each other. We need to organize ourselves in a nonviolent, wise, and smart way to take control of this world the way we should take it.
Civil disobedience, Ted, right?
And I've done a lot of civil disobedience, probably more than anybody else in this country on the issue of homelessness, and it does work, as long as we keep it nonviolent and respectful. And let's not be like the Occupy Wall Street people who went up banging on the doors of the tycoons, cursing them out, yelling at them, and to their surprise, the tycoons answered the door, and they said, okay, kids, what do you want? And they didn't have a clue as to what to do, and therefore they lost a great momentum. I want to bring to the world, if you read some of my material, I want to bring a vision to America and to the world, a global vision whereby we can unite through this communication system and we can begin to shut whole nations down and make them do what we want them to do. But we must first have a strong body politic with an agenda. So we knock on the door and he says, this time, what do you guys want? We can tell them exactly what it is that we want and how it's to be done without threatening their position.
I sometimes despair, though, Ted, that we don't care about one another anymore. We live in this technological age of internet. You take the bus occasionally, Ted. I'm sure, like me, you drive a car, but I'm sure you sometimes take the bus as well and the train. And you know, you probably remember a time when you sat on a bus or a train, and the guy or the woman next to you had a conversation with you. We're glued to these devices. We've become incredibly selfish. You know what, Ted? When a corrupt bank comes to a neighbourhood and tries to force a family out of a home wrongly, you know, because of a dodgy mortgage or whatever, we should come together as a community and prevent that. This is sort of non-violent civil disobedience I'm talking about. But Ted, guys like you are rare. We don't care about one another anymore, Ted. We're consumed by consuming, and we're consumed by selfishness and narcissism. We don't give a damn. Am I wrong? I think we might have lost Ted briefly there. I hope he's not hung up in despair at what I just said. Are you still there, Ted? We might have lost him momentarily. Tell you what we'll do. We'll take a very quick... in fact, I won't. I'll attempt to disconnect and reconnect to him. Sometimes when you do that, it rejigs it. Fascinating this. Ted Hayes, live from Los Angeles, very, very well-known commentator, very well-known activist, civil rights activist, and advocate, a terrific advocate for the rights of homeless people in L.A. Ted, I'm sorry, we lost you momentarily.
No worries. What I was saying to you is that I have to disagree with you on two points. One, there are more people like me in this world. They do exist. Believe me, they do exist. Two, and like you. Two, most people do care. They just don't know what to do. It is the job of guys like you and me to come together, let's coordinate together and build a tangible vision of hope. And let's do it through this internet system that they have given us. It's a gift from God if we use it correctly. They're using it. Why shouldn't we use it? It's okay if they don't want to see anybody face to face. I understand that. But at least let's go where they are and give them that kind of a red meat that will draw them out.
I've been doing a bit of homework, of course, on you, Ted, and your campaigns, as you'd expect me to be doing before speaking with you today. And you're incredibly interesting, and you shoot at a multitude of targets, and I think you're really good, Ted. I have to say that. You talk about the impact that immigration has on vital public services. So can you imagine? You can imagine in Los Angeles, 58,000 people are homeless. That's an epidemic. That's an incredible burden on people to be able to deal with that. But unfettered, unlimited immigration, we see it here in Europe. I know you talk a lot about that. How crucial is that, Ted, in what we're talking about?
It's horrible. It's horrible. We call Los Angeles occupied L.A. We have literally millions of people in this country who did not come in this country properly. And basically, for example, we black people, for one thing, blacks in this country, we're only 12% of the general population of America. Yet we're over 60% of the homeless population in the United States of America. Here in Los Angeles, we are only 11% of the general city population. Yet on Skid Row, what we call Ground Zero, the black hole vortex of homelessness, the capital of homelessness, living on the sidewalks by the hundreds in tents and boxes and whatever, makeshift shelters, 90% of those people are black men, followed by black women and their children, then a spattering of the rest. This is a horrible thing. And what woke me up to the invasion occupation, not only illegal immigration, was a black friend of mine who was a veteran of the Marine Corps. He confronted me one day in South Central, and he was saying to me, Ted, you're doing great work with the homeless and the veterans, but as long as the illegals are taking up the funding and the resources and the government's attention, you're not going to be able to resolve the matter. I did not want to listen to him. He would always confront me on this issue because I was an icon in the Hispanic Latino community, most of whom these so-called illegal aliens or invaders are. And they loved me. In fact, I had a cricket team of Mexican boys from Compton called the Homies and the Pops. And we came to England 3 times to play cricket over there, and even in Manchester, in fact. And so they loved me. But when I came out and pointed out that this invasion is actually killing us black folks, it's stopping us from moving forward, they turned on me. They called me a racist, and they called me the N-word and threatened my life. Right now, my life is under threat. I have to really watch where I go and what I do anymore now because of that. I see what's going on over there in England. I was there. I saw it, you know, and in Europe. But you know something? That is our fault. We let these folks in out of a guilt complex, and now look at what's happened to us.
Well, we've destroyed, Ted. We've destroyed countries like Libya, like Iraq, like Syria, and we've done that based on monumental lies, of course. And while you're right to talk, I mean, I presume in Los Angeles there are a lot of economic migrants from Mexico who come in, but around the US you will have refugees from countries that the United States has, let's be honest about it, and the United Kingdom, we've been bombing the bejesus out of and killing millions of people. And you're at it's a paradox that then, because you know it's terrible, you know that our countries shouldn't be involved in these overseas wars, murdering innocent people, and you need to do something for the refugees, but at the same time, you know that it's going to overwhelm vital services for people in Manchester, in Los Angeles and elsewhere. So what do you do without kind of demonising the migrants whom are doing what just most of us would do if we were in their situation? How do you deal with that?
Again, it starts with people like you and I who have the cognizance. We're part of that 1% group as well. You know, we're on the lower end of it, but we're part of it because we're blessed with all kinds of resources. It's up to us to take that question you just asked. We need to sit down and figure out how to inspire those people to have hope and also to challenge the powers that be how not to be militarily and greedily aggressive in other people's country. Look, we have been this way for 6,000 recorded years of history here as humanity. And we've done this time and time and time again. Maybe for the first time in our existence, with 7.25 billion of us, combined with the technology of communication we have and other technology of sciences, perhaps now we can have a movement, a global instant movement, whereby we get the right attitude and we learn what it means to be human and not repeat the sins of the past any longer. There's no group of people on this planet, black, white, brown, red, yellow, Muslim, Jew, Christian, Buddhist, atheist, who have ancestry has added to this situation that you and I today experience. It's not our fault, you guys. We didn't cause this mess. Our ancestors left us this. But therefore, because we are innocent and not guilty, we have the freedom to correct that which they have left us and chart a better course into the future for our children. At least that's what I'm teaching and trying to generate around the world.
I'm really here
in Los Angeles.
I'm really loving speaking with you, Ted. Ted Hayes is on the line. Go to tedhayes.us. I'll tweet out the website. Little bit of echo on the line there. I don't know why that is, but we'll persevere. The problem is, Ted, I see a conspiracy by oligarchs by the financial elite to privatise every square inch of the planet, to gentrify major cities like Los Angeles, London, New York. And they're doing that with the political class. That's what's happening. And it's happening on our watch.
Yeah, it's happening on our watch. And therefore, we're not guilty. We got to remember that, guys. Can't take on the guilt complex because guilt just makes it worse. But we are responsible to be creative, to protect the future by stopping the things of the past from going forward. We're the filters for the future. We've got to start seeing ourselves as those tools, and we can inspire not only the poor and the oppressed, but also the oppressed themselves, the rich. They're human too. We got to remember that. They are human, and there is a God, and we can get to their hearts.
We've got Ted Hayes on the line. We've got Ted just for another couple of minutes. Terrific to have him on the programme. We're talking about the epidemic of homelessness around the world, and it's growing exponentially in Los Angeles. It's growing exponentially here in Manchester and in London as well. Ted, talk to me about, you know, civil disobedience. Could we ever see, do you think, civil disobedience on the scale that we saw with Gandhi, where hundreds of thousands of people, maybe millions of people, speak to the system and say, do you know what? Not anymore. We're not complying anymore.
Yes, yes. We have the tools at hand to do all of that in every country simultaneously. We can do this. It's just a matter of having a vision of what it is that we want of the powers that be. We don't want to make the mistake of the 60s or the mistake of the civil rights movement here in the United States or the mistake of the recent Occupy Wall Street. We have got to have our act together so that we can sit down and negotiate with them. But we must also tie them down through actions of civil disobedience if necessary. Absolutely correct.
One of the things, Ted, that I'm very interested in is identity politics. How we see the world from the point of view of the social group that we want to belong to or that we do belong to. So I'm an Irish guy. I'm a white Irish guy from Waterford City in Ireland, living in the UK. I suppose I was guilty of seeing the world from the point of view that, well, I'm a socialist, I'm an Irish socialist. People see the world from the point of view of, well, I'm a right winger, I'm a conservative, or I'm an Asian man, or I'm a black man. Do we need to get away from identity politics, Ted, and remember that first and foremost, we are spiritual beings having this experience on Earth, and we need to think like that in order to move on. What do you think?
You're absolutely correct. I agree with that. That's how I see myself as well. I see myself as a spirit that has descended into a human body. And for some reason, the great spirit chose to place me in the United States of America in this African descended body of mine and give me the wisdom and the experience that I have that I may apply this and get the word around the world to other people. I don't believe that we should ignore our colors or our religions. I think that that's our strength, but we should respect one another and love one another and transcend our prejudices about people. And this is the best time in human history when we can do that.
I was obviously going to bring it up, Ted, about the cricket. I'm a rare breed. I'm an Irishman that loves cricket, watch Test cricket all the time, watch England. I didn't get to know too much about your formative years, but presumably you grew up in the US, not known for its love of cricket. How in the name of God, Ted, did you get into cricket?
That's funny. My friend Katie Haber, who's also British, she was here working for me at the Dome Village. And one day the Beverly Hills Cricket Club needed an 11th man because their regular guy didn't show up. And she couldn't find anybody. So after coercing me, I decided to go play. And I went and I played with the Beverly Hills guys. I loved the game. I love the dance of it, but I also love, most importantly, the etiquette of the game. So we brought it back. We taught it to homeless people. We took a trip of homeless guys to England in 1996, I think it was. Then we came back and built a team of young boys from Compton, Mexican boys. We went back over there. But here's an interesting story. We ran into Jerry Adams one day, Martin McGuinness, in Parliament. And he looked at me and I looked at him. We looked strange at each other. And so we introduced ourselves to one another. And he asked me, what was I doing in England? I said, I was playing cricket at the time. I didn't know Irish people did not believe in cricket. But what do I know? Dumb American, right? And so I said, I'll tell you what, Mr. Adams, how about the next time we're in England, we play you a match of cricket? And he looked at Mark McGuinness, and they smiled at each other, right? And condescendingly said, yeah, sure, we'll play some cricket. Just let us know when you're back in town. So we took him serious. So 2 years later, we called Jerry. We said, hey, Mr. Adams, we're in England. You want to play that cricket match? He says, all right, if you can get to Belfast. So we got to Belfast. We called him. He says, okay, meet me at Stormont. So we went to Stormont. We met Jerry Adams, Mark McGuinness. We couldn't play because there wasn't enough time, but we presented them a cricket bat and a cricket ball. Jerry Adams held a cricket bat and a cricket ball, so did Mark McGuinness. And we gave David Trumbull, I think he was a Protestant guy, a hurley stick and a hurley ball to kind of do a peace between the two countries. And you know what? It helped the peace. It helped the peace accord because they were able to move it forward after that. I said to Jerry Adams and Mark McGuinness, I said, look, guys, if you would show the English people that you're really, really serious, if you take up cricket, you're taking your life in your hands. But if you do that, you're letting the Brits know you're serious about peace. And they said, you know what? We'll try it. And sure enough, 2 months later, they had a breakthrough.
Ted, I could speak with you all night. I'm going to invite you back on the program again. Before we do part company today, though, first of all, thanks for the work that you've done throughout your life, because it resonates all over the world. It doesn't just resonate in Los Angeles. Thanks for doing the things that you've done to help other people and continue to do those as well. But for every father who has a son or a daughter who competes at sports, whether it's soccer, cricket, track and field, what is it like as a daddy when your little girl wins an Olympic gold medal in Athens in Greece in 2004? Describe that feeling, Ted.
Yeah, man, I was there with my wife, my youngest son, and we were in the stadium, and there we saw that little girl who said years before she wanted to win a gold medal, and sure enough, there she was in the home of the Olympics. She won the 110-meter hurdles in record-breaking time, 12.7 seconds. It was just an amazing thing to experience, and now she was coaching at UCLA, her alma mater, but now she's coaching track and field for USC here in Los Angeles. So isn't that a great story? Thank God, huh?
It's a marvelous story. Thanks for coming on, Ted. It's tedhayes.us, by the way. Do me a favor, Ted. Give us a call whenever there's something going on that we should know about. Give us a call and we'll get you back on.
I certainly will. Can I give you my website?
Yes,
please?
Go ahead.
Go to Dome, D-O-M-E, Village. DomeVillage.us, DomeVillage.us, or TedHayes.us, and you'll get to me, okay? Looking forward to hearing from you guys, and blessings and cheers, and thank you, Richard Allen, for inviting me to come on and share my views with your folks, man. God bless you, brother.
The honor was mine. God bless you, Ted. Thanks very much for doing it, my friend, and thanks to your friend for setting it up as well. Lovely, lovely, lovely man. Spent decades, and still does, looking out for the rights of the worst off in society. That was Ted Hayes, live on the line from Los Angeles. Delighted to have met Ted, and we'll get him back on the programme again in the near future. It's exactly 27 minutes to the top of the hour. A lot of comments coming in on this particular subject. Let's have some Marvin Gaye, though. This is Marvin Gaye. A little bit of music this Thursday. When we come back, I'll read your Twitter comments. Mark tweets, I wouldn't hand Martin McGuinness a cricket bat. Maybe not. This is some song, back in a minute.
Mother, mother, there's too many of you crying. Brother, 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 there's far too many of you dying. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love. Don't need to escalate. You see, war is not the answer, for only love can conquer hate. You know we've got to find a way to bring some love and get here today. Oh, picket lines and picket signs. Punish me with brutality. Talk to me so you can see, oh, what's going on.
Marvin Gaye on the Richie Allen Show. What a song that is. What's going on? It's 24 minutes to the top of the hour. Let me just quickly get into some of the comments there. Big shout out to Jen C, my friend in California. How you doing, Jen? Nice to know you're listening today. Jen sent me that lovely meme of George Carlin. George said, "There is no war on homelessness," said George. "Do you want to know why? There's no money in that problem. Nobody stands to get rich off of that problem. If you could find a solution to homelessness where the corporate swine and the politicians could steal a couple of million dollars each, you would see the streets of America clean up pretty goddamn quick. I guarantee you that." That was George Carlin many years ago. Brilliant meme. Thanks for that, Jen. Hi to Gail as well. Rich tweets, "It's a sick society when 1% have everything you could dream of, then in the same town there are people with nothing. Very sad." And Grant Montgomery is listening to the programme in Hawaii. He says, "Richie, love the show, thank you so much. The homelessness problem in Honolulu, Hawaii, is completely out of control. Many tourists complain about it, and now... and vow even that they will never return again. Similar reasons for the issue as in Los Angeles. Politicians doing nothing but trying to make police-like park rangers to enforce the oppressive laws in areas outside of police jurisdiction. It's really heartbreaking," says Grant, who's listening in Hawaii. Grant, thanks so much for the email. I really appreciate that. Let me scroll up because I did miss quite... a few tweets as I was speaking to Ted. Mark Morrison tweets that Georgia's solution was to build on golf courses. Wow, I'd love to see that. And then he says, 4 big golf tournament going on just up the road, of course. The Open is going on just up the road from us near Liverpool, isn't it, this week? I believe, indeed. Big thanks to Busy for the RT clip. I've retweeted that out as well. Again, the best way to see what other people are tweeting to me is to go to twitter.com where it says search Twitter, put at Richie Allen Show. No, put Richie Allen Show, Richie Allen Show, all one word, and press enter. Millie says, "Stop eating meat /death. That would be a good start. I'm well aware that that's a very... that's an opinion shared by some of our listeners, Millie. I don't agree with it, but thanks for tweeting that. I know it's your opinion. Free Spirit tweets, "Richie, people are glued to the phones. They're full of vaccines and fluoride, programmed by the media to be selfish. How do we combat that?" says Free Spirit. Great question. It's a great question. Angela says that in Folkestone, where she lives, there are many groups of people that do care about the homeless. Thank God for that, says Angela. As well, I know as I'm scrolling through here I'm missing a lot of tweets. I really apologise for that. A lot of them have come in. Catherine tweets that horrendous sign in London, that horrendous street sign saying "Please do not give money to beggars." How sick and pathetic do you have to be? How completely inhumane do you have to be to tell people not to help people out by offering them a sandwich or a cup of tea or a couple of bob? It's sick, isn't it? It's absolutely sick. Let me scroll up again. Do you know, as I'm scrolling up, another 25 tweets have just come in. You know what? It's not easy. It's nice to get so many tweets, but I lose so many of them. JP in Manchester sent me the tweet that says, "More than 70 members of Parliament and 140 members of the House of Lords have interests in private healthcare firms. Should these people be trusted with the NHS? No, JP, they should not. Absolutely right. They should not at all. None whatsoever. James tweets, child abuse needs to be stamped out and it's the top of the tree that are up to it. Yes, it is at. It is an epidemic amongst VIP, the captains of industry and politicians. There's no doubt about that as well. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'm going to take a very quick break. When I come back, I'll try and get up to date with these tweets. A lot of interesting tweets coming in on this particular programme.
Is your mind full of ideas, yet you struggle to put them down on paper? Characters with no home, unfinished concepts that you always wanted to finalise, yet lacked knowledge and drive to complete? The Creative Writing Course from Creative Imagings may be the long-awaited answer. Designed to help you finish your masterpiece with better language techniques, detailed study of the character, plotted suspense chain, and valuable information to get published. Don't delay your creation. Sign up today. Email Sue on nassusproductions@gmail.com.
Have you lost access to important data from a computer hard drive, mobile phone, or other storage device? Maybe you have a broken hard drive containing years of information, or a smartphone that no longer works from which you'd like the pictures, movies, and chats recovered. If you would like to recover data from any type of digital device, including desktop and laptop computers, external hard drives, cameras, smartphones, NAS, and RAID servers, then contact Data Clinic today at dataclinic.co.uk now.
Introducing the H2O app, a powerful water structuring application that programs vibrational energies into water through the use of different sound frequencies. Once programmed, the use of water for drinking, cooking, bathing. Give it to your friends and colleagues or spread it around the garden. The list goes on. It's not just water that the app can be used for either. It's great for programming crystals too. The H2O app is free to download and is available on both Android and Apple platforms. For further information, go to h2oapp.online.
For critical information ignored by the mainstream media, log on to davidicke.com/headlines now.
Yeah, I was kind of half asleep there. I wasn't actually. No, I was reading tweets. A lot of tweets coming in. Tristan tweets, what a lovely man Ted Hayes is. Warms my heart and gives me hope to hear people like him. It's exactly 17 and a half minutes to the top of the hour as well. Hi to Gio as well. How you doing, Gio? Thanks for listening to the programme. And to Peter McTwowheels, who says, what a quality guest. It makes you feel very humble listening to him. He was a quality guest and we'll be inviting him back on the programme again. Simple as that, eh? This is Alice Cooper on the Richie Allen Show for Thursday, July 20th, 2017. Love this. There's no rhyme or reason to the music chosen by me, by the way. There's no pattern. There's no genre guide. It's whatever I feel like hearing. Back with more of your comments and much more besides after this. This is Poison. Poison.
Time.
Alice Cooper on the Richie Allen Show. When I was speaking with Ian Puddick in the first hour, I saw an alert from one of my wires, one of the news agencies I use, that said that the lead singer of Linkin Park, a man called Chester Bennington, has taken his own life. His body was found around about 5 o'clock UK time today. He was 41 when he died. If you're a fan of the music of Linkin Park, you might not know that. You might not be, you might be distressed. You might be sad to hear that. Chester Bennington, the lead singer of Linkin Park, took his own life today. What's interesting about that, and not to be disrespectful at all, I'm not disrespectful at all, but apparently he was close with the Soundgarden singer, Chris Cornell, who committed suicide back in May. Linkin Park are a pretty big band. I've never been into their music, but a massive band. They've sold not far from 100 million albums over the years, and they've won a couple of Grammys as well. So Chester Bennington, aged 41, committed suicide, was found today. Just mentioning that, it's not the sort of thing we would do on this programme, but some of our listeners might say it for me. Some of our listeners might be interested in Linkin Park and the music of that band. It's exactly 11 and a half minutes to the top of the hour. Interesting question posed by a listener called Jay Ferguson about my choosing to eat meat and asking me to explain why I do so. I don't explain why I do anything to anybody, least of all to somebody using a pseudonym on Twitter whom I don't know, never have known, and probably never will know. Why I eat meat and why I choose not to not eat meat is my business. End of story. If you don't like it, fuck off. Listen to another radio programme. We're past the watershed now. I can say what I want. I can't stand these people with ideologies who want to inflict them on other people, want to inflict their view of the world and what's right and what's wrong on somebody else. You be whoever you want to be and do whatever you want to do and expect that other people respect you for that. But it goes both ways. You respect other people for choosing to live the life they want to live and be done with it. Or don't. And like I said, fuck off and listen to another radio programme. It's as simple as that. I've no time for these idiots. You know, I've no time for it. Muppets. Complete Muppets. Waste of time, waste of space. Demanding that I explain why I eat meat. You know, fuck right off. End of story. Right, got a couple of things to tell you. That was rather abrupt and unbecoming of a professional radio presenter. It probably is, but I have no time for it. I've no time for people like that. None. None. Believe what you want to believe and I'll respect it. But don't inflict it upon me and don't demand of me that I tell you. Don't make smart comments about, or your guests would have to give an explanation. I'm not a guest of anybody. I'm not being interviewed by anybody for anything, so I don't have to explain why I eat meat. I eat meat because I eat meat. End of story. I think I've made that quite clear. 9 minutes to the top of the hour. Now, David is doing three events. Two in England, one in London, one in Edinburgh. And he's doing another event in Manchester. Now, those events are to coincide with the release of David's forthcoming book, which will be released in the autumn sometime. I'll be comparing in Manchester and I'll be comparing in London as well. The Edinburgh event, I believe, is sold out. To find out more about the events and, of course, the Worldwide Wake Up Tour, do go to davidicke.com to find out more about that. Brilliant. I love this. Paul Jameson. That's the shittiest reason I've ever heard, Richie. I eat meat because I eat meat. Do I have to have a reason to breathe? Do I have to explain what clothes I'm wearing? Do I have to explain why it is I choose to watch certain television programmes? No, I don't. Nor do I owe any explanation to you, Paul, or anybody else as to why I choose to eat meat. End of story. So Paul, like Jay before him, fuck off. Fuck right off. How about them apples? the goal of people. Freedom, freedom, free speech, freedom to choose, freedom to do what you want, unless I don't fucking like it. Muppets. Absolute Muppets. Tongue firmly in cheek here. It's funny, huh? It's funny. If you want to believe that eating meat is murder, you hold on to that. You embrace that. And you live that. I have, like I said before, respect for your decision to do that. But I owe you no explanation whatsoever. Are you fucking listening to me? I don't have to explain myself to you or to anybody else as to what I do, when I do it, and when I don't do it. No more than you have to explain to me why you choose not to eat meat, why you choose to be a vegan or a freegan or whatever else it is that you've decided to be. Again, freedom of choice, freedom of expression, until it's something that you disagree with. It's wonderful, really, isn't it? Most people, of course, don't have the inward capacity to look at themselves and say, yeah, he's actually right. Why should I be demanding that he explain to me why he eats meat? Who the hell are you to explain? Who the hell are you to ask me to explain anything? I don't owe you any explanation for anything. I make a radio program. You listen or you don't. What I do and what I don't do is none of your business. Outside of that, you have the right to say, I couldn't possibly listen to a radio presenter who eats meat. Then you'd be like Morrissey. Then, fuck off. Find a radio presenter who makes programs who's a vegan and enjoy his or her program. All right. Good stuff. That's about it for the show today. My plan was to do a program tomorrow, a news program. I'm still planning to do that, but I completely forgot, thank God for diaries. I had forgotten that I'd arranged to meet somebody out of town to talk about, hopefully, drumming up a bit of sponsorship and a bit of advertising for the programme. And I don't want to miss that. So I'm hoping that I can do that and also do a roundup programme, a news programme tomorrow. All going well, I will do that. Failing that, Sunday View will, of course, be live on Sunday at 11 a.m. BST. Chris tweets, Richie, they're only asking you a question. Don't answer and don't tell them if you don't want. They're not asking a question, Chris. It's the aggressive tone and the aggressive nature with which they're doing it. They're not asking a question. They're aggressively demanding. They're not asking a question. They are demanding an explanation for me doing something that they choose not to do. And like I said, and remember, tongue firmly in cheek here, when I say fuck off, it's not the very aggressive, angry, I'd kill you, fuck off. It's just fuck off. It's none of your business. I'm not going to have a conversation with you about why I choose to eat meat, why I choose to wear pink t-shirts sometimes, why I watch certain television programs on television. I'm not going to do that. You do what you do, I'll do what I do. You believe what you want to believe, I'll believe what I want to believe. Like I said, we live in a free world. You make the decision. I couldn't listen to a guy on the radio who eats meat. He's a murderer. Fine. Fuck off. Simple as that. Millie says, Richie is triggered. Millie, I'm not. I'm not. And I don't hold anything against anybody. I just get angry with people who want to inflict their worldview on others. Don't do that. And don't do that. I'm going to leave you with some Bruce Springsteen. This is a song called This Life. That was a nice way to end. That was a nice way to end the program after that lovely conversation we had with Ted Hayes. Right, this is Bruce. Look after yourselves and one another. Thanks for being with me this week. Have a great rest of your Thursday. Bye now.